edition of the Fifth Down Podcast. I am your host, Mike Fiella, flying solo for today's show. In first and second down, I am joined by the first time in Fifth Down Podcast history, our first two-segment guest, the host of the Bueller's Day Off program, Julie Bueller, to discuss all things National Football League. In addition, the touching on the NBA and the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame. In third down, I break down the Arizona State University of Arizona contest. In fourth down, we ponder the question, what is to become of the Honey Badger, Tyrann Mathieu? Remember, you can get in touch with the show. You can tweet me at Fifth Down Mike or email the show at fifthdowncfb@gmail.com. Without further ado, let's hop in to First Down. Into First Down now, I am joined by the host of Bueller's Day Off, which you can find 12 to 2 on 1010 KXPS. She is the host of that show, Julie Bueller. How are you?
I'm excellent. Aptly named show that I actually, my job is Bueller's Day Off. That's pretty good stuff.
Well, listen, you know, I could find the Bueller sound effect if you want, but I'm sure you've heard that ad nauseum, I'm sure.
If you want to hear a story, I actually ran into Ben Stein on a street down here in Southern California. I walked straight up to the man and I said, "Do you realize what you've done to my life?" I used to have a last name, but now I'm capitalizing on it. So God bless America.
Listen, that's what it's all about. You can't fight City Hall, right?
That's right.
So, Julie, we brought you in to talk about the NFL, among other things. Mm-hmm. The big stories of the day, or the big story of the day, I should say, is the San Francisco 49ers, their quarterback situation. They had Alex Smith as their starter all the way up to the NFC Championship game last season until an injury this year. And now there's been a switch. They're going with Colin Kaepernick, the kid from Nevada. What are your impressions of the switch? What should we expect from Kaepernick?
Well, you got to look in this in two different ways. Number one, Alex Smith has sure been good this year. And he has a better road passer rating, 111.4 on the road. He's one of five or six quarterbacks in the NFL with a passer rating above 100. And, oh, by the way, limits the turnovers. Now, is he as explosive? Is he as dynamic? Is he as much of an athlete as Kaepernick? No, and it's not even close, and you don't even need much of a brain to figure that out. But when you look at what he does well, he works within the system really well. Now, when you look at what happened with the Rams, he was 7-for-8 for 72 yards and a touchdown, got a concussion, and he's bounced. Kaepernick comes in, he goes 11-for-17 for 117 yards, doesn't throw for a touchdown, but runs, I think, for 68 yards and a touchdown. And the Niners score 17 points in the fourth quarter of that game and come back to tie against the Rams. And then you look at what Kaepernick did against the Bears and then his performance against the Saints, and it's tough to argue with the notion that Kaepernick is a better playmaker and a better athlete. But if you're asking me which quarterback I want to take into the playoffs and I want to take on the road and stretch runs where turnovers kill your momentum and turnovers will absolutely thwart your efforts on defense specifically, I'd have to go with Alex Smith, and I'd have to think that he's the safer bet. Is Kaepernick a more explosive, kind of prettier option? Yeah, no question. I think that's pretty easy to see, but I think Alex Smith is the guy that has been very effective in the offense thus far and should be the starting quarterback. But Jim Harbaugh knows what he wants out of his team, and he's chosen to go with Kaepernick. Dante Whitner said that Kaepernick has been the guy since he was drafted to get to the weight room first thing in the morning. He's the first one there. He's the last one to leave. And he's put himself in this position to be successful. So, you know, it's kind of a conundrum in that you wonder, well, gosh, how does Alex Smith lose his job? But at the same time, how do you take it away from Kaepernick? Because all he's done is be successful.
Absolutely. I agree with you. It is difficult, though, comparing the two. It's like Alex Smith is... He's almost like your Hyundai Sonata, right? Kaepernick is your Maserati. I mean, clearly they have different skill sets, but Alex Smith has been dynamite since Coach Harbaugh has been there. He took him to the NFC Championship game, played fantastic against the Saints in the divisional round. It is tough to lose your job due to injury, but Kaepernick is explosive. But I would argue the 49ers are a defensive team. They don't want to turn the football over. Maybe that's Alex Smith, but Kaepernick does give you explosive run plays, and with the loss of Kendall Hunter, it is tough. Maybe Kaepernick is the right call now. He's definitely going to be the quarterback in the future, but it is tough for Alex Smith to go out that way. What is the buzz around Niner fans?
Yeah, I'm not even really worried that much about the sentimentality of, oh, this is so hard for Alex Smith. I'm not really buying into that because, look, this is a business. And if I suck at my radio, I expect to get replaced. And if you're not performing well, you expect to be replaced. Or guess what else? If someone comes along, if you've been eating vanilla ice cream your whole life and all of a sudden you throw in some Rocky Road, it's not a big deal that you switch to Rocky Road because it's more fun to eat. That's right. Not that big of a deal. But the bottom line is you're right. This is a team that wants to win games. It's built with a running game and defense. It's a possession football team. If you have a guy that's high risk, high reward, as Colin Kaepernick is, now he's only thrown one interception against the Saints. He almost threw two, but you can see that gunslinging mentality. He loves to throw into tight spaces, and right now he's been getting away with it because defensive coordinators and defenses don't have much tape on him. But I guarantee you he's going to have a game where he throws three interceptions and the Niners lose, and you're going to be scratching your head going, gosh, would they have won that game if Alex Smith was at the helm being judicious and safe? And while fantasy players, while a lot of fans love that high-flying action, the bottom line is you don't want to give the opposition any more opportunities to score than you have to.
Absolutely.
The Niners have been really good. In fact, they set an NFL record last year in turnover margin. They beat the New England Patriots' obscene record of 27, plus 27. They had plus 28 last year. The reason that's possible is because Alex Smith takes care of the football. So what happens now is Kaepernick will move forward. As long as he's winning, everything's fine. But when you're in the playoffs, again, I think we both agree here, Mike, you got to look at who's the safer bet, and Alex Smith certainly seems like that. But, you know, again, is Kaepernick fun to watch? Yeah, he's actually really fun to watch.
Nah, that's true. I mean, Alex Smith had the Niners within two Kyle Williams fumbles away of maybe beating the Giants and going to the Super Bowl, at which point you throw their hands up, and who knows? Do they beat the Patriots? Do they not? I mean, it doesn't really matter much now, but that would have been a great game. And he is definitely, it's unbelievable to say, right, the stigma around Alex Smith is that he was a bust and it wasn't the bill of goods that was sold, but he has been very effective and efficient, and that is what the Niners have needed. Which brings us to another team of primetime game Thursday night, the Jets and Patriots. Talk about guys that turned the football over. That was the New York Jets. Fumbles, interceptions. Mark Sanchez has a play in which he runs into his right guard. Wait a minute.
He doesn't run into his right guard. He face plants into his ass and then falls backwards.
Well, that's true.
That is the ultimate Chris Farley. I can say that on your podcast, can I?
Yes, you
that's
can.
That's the ultimate Chris Farley-esque comedy live on Thanksgiving Day in front of the nation.
I know. It's unbelievable. Last week I had a monologue in which I asked the New York Jets, at which point should you go to Tim Tebow? That was before I knew he had the broken ribs. But at which point do you not go to Mark Sanchez? Do you go to McElroy, Tebow? It's a whole thing that Rex Ryan is going to have to figure out. But the Jets did not even look competitive in the first half of that game. It was unbelievable. I have never seen an NFL team crumble like that. And, of course, Murphy's Law, it has to happen on a Thursday night primetime game against, of course, the New England Patriots. What do you think we'll see from the Jets the rest of the season?
You know, that's a great question, Mike. And gosh, it's a conundrum because ultimately I'm a huge Rex Ryan fan. And I actually don't think that his game plan coming into the season was that bad. I think Mike Tannenbaum has stocked his cupboards full of makings of Rice Krispie treats. and you know, Rex Ryan wanted to make some lasagna and he doesn't have the right ingredients. And I think that that relationship, that marriage has been a complete disaster. And it seems like Tannenbaum doesn't really care. He's not really giving Ryan the pieces. Every head coach has a specific skill set, has specific requirements for the team that they want to run. And if the GM and the head coach are not on the same page, you see this kind of debacle in New York. And I think ultimately that needs to end first. I think Rex Ryan is a tremendous head coach. You don't come in as a rookie head coach with a rookie quarterback and get to the AFC title game and then do that again in your sophomore years unless you're a really good coach. But right now, the Jets just are not a good team. They don't have a running attack. Their offensive line is banged up. They have zero pass rush. This team used to be one of the better defenses in the NFL, and it's Swiss cheese now. And you have to look at the front office, not so much at Rex Ryan, although Ryan gets all the publicity and the media tend to steer their attention on him. I look squarely at the front office, and I look at that team on the field. You look at the team on paper, you're not blown away. You look at them on the field, and it's downright sad.
I hear you. You know what's troubling is that Mark Sanchez, Rex Ryan, and the Jets got to the AFC Championship game 2 years in a row. It's rookie in his sophomore year. He had his rookie season. He had 28 turnovers, 20 interceptions, 8 fumbles, 13 interceptions, 5 fumbles, 18 turnovers, 17 touchdowns his sophomore year, and 12 his first year. The defense was so good. It seemed at times they were winning in spite of Mark Sanchez. But now, with the defense eroding without Darrell Revis, players like Barks Scott, they really can't seem to run anymore. Antonio Cromartie has played well in the secondary, but they don't have any safeties that are any good. The defense just can't carry the burden. And when you have wide receivers that frankly aren't very good, Jeremy Curley, I'd say he's a slot receiver. But other than Stephen Hill, they don't have anybody that has big play potential. And even Stephen Hill can't even hold on to the ball. I don't know if it's all Mark Sanchez, but I agree with you. Tannenbaum has not done a good job. If he's the GM of the Jets next year, I would be stunned because he has given Rex Ryan nothing. You're 100% right.
Yeah, and you know, it's a tough thing, Mike, to find that perfect balance between your head coach and your general manager. And a few teams have accomplished it. And guess what? They're usually the teams that are at the top of the pack. But if you have a general manager that's a little headstrong, like A.J. Smith is in San Diego, and he hires a head coach that probably is more of a yes man than he is an actual good, solid head coach in Norv Turner, then you see the type of thing that you're seeing in San Diego. Or you see two guys that have different philosophies. That's what's going on in New York with the Jets. But when you can get the franchise on the same page, good things can happen. Look at what's happening with Indianapolis. That franchise went through a drastic facelift. You go from Bill Polian to first-time GM, 39 years old, Ryan Grigson. You go from Jim Caldwell to the fireball, Chuck Pagano. You go from Peyton Manning, hasn't missed a start in his 13-year career, to Andrew Luck. I mean, it's just, this is absolute about faith, but because Jim Irsay, the owner of the Colts, understands team chemistry and understands vision and kind of the basic fundamental paradigm that he wants to lead his franchise through, those things work out. And he chooses good people. Even Chuck Pagano goes down. Guess what? His OC, the interim head coach, Bruce Arians, oh, by the way, 7-4 this season. I mean, that's – so it requires great leadership. And it's a tough thing to do, Mike. There's no formula. But when it's right, you know it and you see it. And the winning column and you know, the win-loss record reflects it. When it's not, gosh, it goes bad fast.
It's absolutely true. You know, I'm happy you brought up Norv Turner. People or players and analysts like Troy Aikman, whose football IQ is higher than mine, swear by him as offensive prowess. But it's unbelievable how San Diego has just fallen apart. I mean, and Phillip Rivers' play has drastically declined, even from a couple years ago. I don't think he's just totally eroded. They're a mess. And you're right, Indianapolis is fantastic. They're the once-in-a-lifetime team that loses Peyton Manning and replaces them with Peyton Manning Lite, Andrew Luck. But do you think that all that is on ownership? So the San Diego owner and Woody Johnson and the Jets, they should be more active, maybe active like Jerry Jones, or should they just clean house and just bring new people in?
You know, I don't know if it's a level of activity. I think it's a level of instinct. And I think some people, and it's not just NFL owners, it's some people are just good at knowing what's necessary to move forward in the right direction. Some people don't have that instinct. I don't think Jerry Jones actually has a lot of talent on that Cowboys team. He is not good at picking head coaches. He doesn't know how to pick a good head coach. And I think that's been the biggest deficiency with the Cowboys. Whereas if you look at the Colts, you know, you had a guy like Tony Dungy and Bill Polian, and they worked well together. I mean, who would have thought of that? Jim Irsay sensed that. He has that instinct. And, you know, full disclosure, I worked for the Colts last season. I got to see that team really up close and the patience of the ownership as the team was, you know, circling the drain and going down the drain was pretty profound. Then you look at San Diego and you look at how Dean Spanos is very hands-off. He lets his GM, A.J. Smith, have all the reins. And A.J. Smith, again, had big problems with Marty Schottenheimer, fired him in 2006 after a 14-2 season, hires Norv Turner, who, okay, let's say he's a great offensive guy. Let's say he helps out his quarterback. That's fine. But look, I'll never be Martha Stewart. Norv Turner's never going to be a good head coach. That's just, he needs to play to his strengths. Some people are built to be the chief financial officer. Not everyone's built to be a CEO. And I think that not all NFL owners are good at recognizing those qualities in people. Robert Kraft, another owner, tremendous instinct.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, it's something that you can't really put your finger on.
But, yeah, that's true. But I would say the Colts ownership, the patience clearly helped there. But what hurt them the most was the fact that Peyton Manning did so much for them. You lose him, you replace him with quarterbacks that not nearly as productive. I mean, Curtis Painter and Dan Orlovsky, they couldn't even hold Peyton Manning's gym
bag.
Don't
forget Kerry Collins. Kerry Collins started the season for the Colts. Yeah, that was a scary option.
Yeah, that was a great $4 million hire. But hey, it's not my money, so who am I to judge, right? So speaking of teams that seemed in disarray, the Green Bay Packers were rolling. They came into the game 7-3. They come out 7-4, and they didn't just get beat. They got drummed 38-10 on Sunday night. Again, a nationally televised game. We are used to seeing Aaron Rodgers put 38 on people, not only put up 10. Is this an overreaction, or is there something seriously wrong with Green Bay?
No, there's something seriously wrong with them, and it's their offensive line. Look what the Niners did in week one, and now look what the Giants have done. If there is a serious pass rush on the other side of Aaron Rodgers, he has a real tough time getting the ball off to his receivers. And oh, by the way, they have no running game. Now,
right. When
Cedric Benson comes back, and he should be back in a week or two, I think that will help them immensely. Just him being in the backfield, just the threat of a guy pounding out the middle will be significant, and they are so desperate for that help. Ultimately, that was a shock, because the last two times these two teams have met, it's been such a good, close game, other than the playoff game last year, that you were really looking forward to this Sunday night showdown, and then Green Bay just face planted and really made the Giants look like one of the better teams in the NFC, which, you know, I still have question marks about their secondary, But, it's their offensive line. So much of the NFL starts in the line play. If you can have a good pass rush on the defensive line, you're going to do good things. And if you can have a solid offensive line, you're going to be okay. But the Packers need a lot of help. They, of course, have injuries, plenty of them. But look, every team in the NFL has injuries. And let's not forget that the Packers won the Super Bowl as the sixth seed after coming into the playoffs 10-6 and, you know, having a very rough end into the playoffs and then rolled through the playoffs. So is it possible for them to recover? No question. When Aaron Rodgers is your quarterback, it's always possible. But they definitely need some help with the running attack, and that offensive line has got to be shored up.
Yeah, that offensive line definitely has to do better. Rodgers was sacked 5 times for 29 yards. We can remember the infamous Golden Tate interception touchdown game. He was sacked 8 times at the end of the first half for a Seattle team, which is a very good defense and a very good pass rush. So the Packers definitely have some deficiencies. For the Giants, the flip side, they do have the great pass rush between Tuck, Umanyora, Kiwanuka. They have a lot of Jason Pierre-Paul. They have great defensive rush guys, but that's still a 28-point beating is still, I would say, surprising, especially with the way Eli Manning played, the 3 touchdowns, no interceptions. He had been on a cold streak recently. I think the Giants probably will be the best team, obviously, in the NFC's division. They are the best team now. They'll probably finish that way, but I'm not sold on them either. I mean, they were Dez Bryant 2 fingers away from losing at Dallas. They did not show up in Cincinnati, so it is tough. The NFC is tricky. Who do you think the best team the NFC is right now?
Oh, not even close. It's the Niners.
Really?
It's not even close. Yeah, it's not even close. And again, as you mentioned earlier, their defense is just ridiculously good, and I almost don't think it matters. who their quarterback is. As far as if you look at what the main teams in the NFC, the Giants present the toughest matchup because of their pass rush. But let's go through the other teams in the NFC. The Bears have zero answer. If Kaepernick starts against the Bears again, they have zero answer. And the Niners' offensive line, most importantly, handled the Bears' pass rush so effectively that it almost made them look like a bunch of scared kittens. And then you look at the Atlanta Falcons. They have a big offense, but there's only four teams in the NFL that give up more rushing touchdowns than the Falcons. You look at what the Niners do. They're going to pound you on the ground with Frank Gore and Brandon Jacobs. And, oh, yeah, they have this kid named LaMichael James who hasn't even been activated this entire season. He's like a secret weapon that they just have in their arsenal. So they've got that going for them. The Packers, as you mentioned, their defense can be gashed. Their offensive line up against the Niners' pass rush would be frightening. As I mentioned, the Giants, a team that I would be scared of. It's going to be interesting to see what the Niners do against the Seattle Seahawks up in Seattle on December 23rd. I am interested to see how the Niners offensive line handles that pass rush. But other than that, who else is there that's really going to present a struggle for the Niners through the NFC?
I hear you. I think Atlanta is overrated. I would like to see them do it in the playoffs. I mean, they come in every single year with a high-flying offense or right. What they used to do, which is pound the ball with Michael Turner, but then they don't show up. Every single year. I mean, Green Bay went in there and beat them. They got destroyed by the Giants in previous seasons. I think the Niners' defense is exceptional, and it makes them probably the number one team. But I'm one of these guys that I really think Jay Cutler makes a huge difference for Chicago. Now Jay Cutler doesn't play defense, so the fact they beat 32-7 doesn't help that they couldn't stop the Niners. That being said, I think Cutler would put up much more points and many more passing yards than Jason Campbell's 107. So they're probably a threat. Green Bay, you can't ever count them out with Rodgers. But I think probably the Giants, I would say, may come out of the NFC. I wouldn't be surprised if the Niners won. What do you expect or see from the AFC?
The AFC, I think, is fascinating, actually. And, you know, if playoffs were to happen right now, you'd have the Colts in Denver for the first round of the playoffs, and I think that would be a fascinating matchup. I think that the Bengals, Mike, are a dark horse in the AFC. And if you look at the rest of the AFC, you have the Patriots. Right now, they're an absolute buzzsaw on offense. And, oh, by the way, getting some huge turnovers and winning defensively. But that's 2 weeks in back-to-back weeks. They had the Colts, and then they had the Jets, where they just annihilated them and embarrassed their opponents. And when you're doing that, it makes that locker room a little bit softer because they're not playing tremendous competition. Same thing with the Denver Broncos. They have a ridiculously soft schedule walking into the playoffs. So it would not surprise me if the Patriots or the Broncos were a first-round bounce, especially if you have a gutty team like the Cincinnati Bengals that they have to face. The Bengals' offense, I like Andy Dalton a lot. He kind of throws a lot of interceptions. He loves to go downfield, but when we have A.J. Green on the other side of that ball, then you're in a good position.
Exactly.
A.J. Green, the number one wide receiver in the NFL right now, has more than double the touchdowns of Calvin Johnson. That is astounding to me. And oh, by the way, their defense is finally catching up and finally starting to play the way we thought they could play, because there's a good defensive line there and there's some good linebackers. So I think that the Bengals are very intriguing to me. I know that the Steelers got punted by the Cleveland Browns and the 8 turnovers was atrocious. I would not want to face that team if I'm the Baltimore Ravens. That team scares me right now because they're like an injured dog that's coming after you. And that's going to be a really fun game to watch. The Ravens scare me because if they're on the road, they're a different team. I thought that this would be the year that the Ravens really take that next step and Joe Flacco puts the team on his shoulders and says, this is my team. And he has to do that because Ray Lewis isn't going to be there much longer. And he might come back this season, but what if he doesn't? Joe Flacco needs to assert himself as the leader of this team. I don't know if he does that in the playoffs, if it's effective. I love what the Texans are doing, Mike. I love J.J. Watt. I love that pass rush. I love Matt Schaub gunning it to Johnson. And how do you oppose Arian Foster? That's one team that has allowed 2 rushing touchdowns on the season, but 19 passing touchdowns. So again, in the playoffs, if you're going up against one of these big passing attacks, the Texans can be gashed. So the AFC is wide open, and I think that more so, the NFC doesn't seem as wide open to me. In the AFC, despite the fact that you have the four division leaders with significant division leads, I think that the top echelon teams in the AFC are all vulnerable. And so it's really going to be dependent on the matchups as to who moves forward in the playoffs.
Yeah, you know, you brought up the soft schedules for the Broncos. The Broncos have upcoming Tampa Bay at 6-5, the Raiders at 3-8. So we could probably assume the Raiders are a win.
So walk in the park. Right. That is a shockingly bad team. That is a shock. The Raiders are impossible to watch.
I can't believe they have three wins. I hear you. They have the Ravens, the Browns, and the Chiefs. The Chiefs at 1-10. The past couple weeks have played much more competitively, but let's be honest, mm-hmm. they can't put up any points.
Look, it's never a good case when you have to look at your team and say, okay, Matt Castle or Brady Quinn, who are we going to go with? That's not a good situation.
That's not a good situation either. And for the Bengals, their schedule is relatively easy as well. They have the Chargers, the Cowboys, mm-hmm. the Eagles. I think those are three winnable games. They mm-hmm. do have the Steelers. Now, without Roethlisberger, that's a game they should win. And
Roethlisberger should be back. Roethlisberger will likely be back by that. He's supposed to come back this week. Might be another week.
Right. No, it's true. But Big Ben, he's a tough guy, obviously. But he does expose himself to a lot of hits. You never know with him if he's ever going to be 100%. But he is a gamer. And they have the Ravens mm-hmm. at the end. The Bengals are a sneaky team. That's a good point. The AFC, though, I find it hard to bet against Tom Brady in the playoffs. I mean, he can put a point sometimes almost at will. But mm-hmm. what's scary, too, with the Patriots, their defense is actually seeming to do what it does at the end of the season, gel, get better. But you're right. It's going to be tough to knock off the Texans. Their defense is elite, but they have been gashed. I mean, they were shredded by Aaron Rodgers on Sunday night a couple weeks back. They don't have Brian Cushing. Let's assume that all the teams that are in the playoffs now, make the playoffs. Who do you think the Super Bowl it would be? Would it be Houston and San Francisco?
The statement I have in general, Mike, when you assess a team in the NFL, the single most disruptive force in all of football is a formidable pass rush.
Yeah.
When the opposition can put your quarterback on his ass, then you're doing something good. When you can put the opposing quarterback on his ass, you're doing something good. And the two best teams with the best pass rush, and it's no mistake, the Houston Texans have specifically built their defense this way. And I love watching it. It's a lot of fun to watch. And I think that what you saw when the Texans went up to Chicago and the way their offensive line controlled that defensive line, specifically on the left side for the Bears, was the thing of beauty. So, yeah, do I think that the Texans can beat the Patriots? No question, because Tom Brady has proven, specifically in the last two Super Bowls he's played in, that when he faces a serious pass rush, he is not the Tom Brady that we know and love. He is a shadow of his former self. And so when the Texans come up with that pass rush, they're going to be able to do some damage on Brady. And oh, by the way, if they have a home field advantage over the Patriots, I think the Texans get that victory. Matt Schaub can carve up that Patriots secondary without much of a problem. And you just give Arian Foster the ball and have him run up the gut. I mean, so, yeah, I love the Texans, and I really like the Niners. I think those two teams have put themselves in the best position to do what you need to do to make it in the playoffs, and that's have a sturdy running game and a solid pass rush.
That's true. It is hard to overcome the pass rush. It's borderline almost impossible if you can't give your quarterback enough time to set and throw and give him enough time to get the football to his playmakers. This season has been, I would say, maybe it's just because I'm young, but it's been surprising to me how many rookies have stepped up and just flawlessly transitioned, similar to Cam Newton last season. Three rookies I think everyone would say are probably on their rookie of the year watch would be Doug Martin, obviously the running back from Tampa Bay, Andrew Luck in Indianapolis, and Robert Griffin the third. Which one of those three do you think will win the award, or will it be somebody else?
I think it'll be Andrew Luck, because if he can take his team to the playoffs, then that is a surprise and a shock. A lot of people thought the Colts might win four games this year, right, and that it would definitely be a rebuilding year. And you watch Andrew Luck and you watch the games, the four games that the Colts have lost. And I think really only one of them, and that was the Patriots game, Andrew Luck really had a hand in the loss, and that if Peyton Manning had been there, they probably would have won that game. Other than that, Andrew Luck has done nothing to make you think that they wouldn't be in a better position with Peyton Manning. As a rookie, with very few weapons, with a revolving door as an offensive line, with a defense that has been, you know, that's given up, what, I think 25 points a game, 24 points a game, something like that?
Right, yeah.
And Andrew Luck is throwing, on average, I think 40 times a game. That's more than Peyton Manning. But each Peyton Manning and Andrew Luck have 29 pass plays of 20 yards or more. So you look at Luck's production, and look, RG3, he's a highlight machine. He's really good at what he does, but his team doesn't have a winning record.
That's true.
They're not in the playoff conversation right now. Could they be? Maybe. But they're not. So right now, you assess the situation, I give it to Andrew Luck. Doug Martin is a great story, but he really came on after the bye week. Before the bye week, the Bucs had a losing record. After the bye week, they've gone, like, I think, 4-2, 5-2, and have basically exploded. And Doug Martin has averaged double yards per carry since the bye week, too. So he's really come on later in the season. Andrew Luck has been there week in, week out, just percolating along, helping his team win ball games.
Yeah, if I had a vote, I would vote for Andrew Luck because he's going to get his team in the playoffs, and he has played well. I mean, his statistics are impressive, but it's hard to overcome RG3. I mean, he does it all, but you make a very valid point.
He puts your jaw on the ground, and he does it really pretty. He does it really pretty, and he's flashy. And, you know, four touchdowns against the Cowboys, that's the thing of beauty, and he's got all the fantasy players salivating. But again, his team's not winning ball games. It's like last year's Cam Newton. You know, congratulations, but you went 6-10.
Yeah.
And if I'm a voter, I look at what Andrew Luck has done. The fact that he doesn't make the same mistake twice. The fact that he's doing more with less. And you know, it's tough to argue. Of course, RG3 is in the NFC. It's a much tougher conference. The AFC does have many more weaker teams, so that might go into the voting as well. But RG3 to me, it's kind of like your Hyundai Sonata versus Aston Martin, you know,
right,
comparison again.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's true. RG3, some of his numbers are absurd. I mean, he's 14 for 15 against the Eagles. Granted, it's the Eagles with four touchdowns. And 14 of 15, that's
unbelievable. Eagles, look, the Eagles are like a White Castle version of the defense. That is a sad, sad defense.
That is. But hey, listen, still 14 out of 15. I mean, one would think, even though they're professionals, hey, occasionally you throw a bad pass. You sail one, and he was pinpoint. And the Cowboys, he shredded the Cowboys for 311
right,
yards and four touchdowns. He also runs, which I think may be the big thing that splits them apart. I mean, it's 99 carries for 642 yards, six touchdowns in that long of 676. So he makes the plays that you're right, the jaw-dropping, they make you think they're the top 10 plays on SportsCenter, whereas Andrew Luck just methodically does what he does at Stanford, does what he did at Stanford, methodically move the ball down the field, taking shots deep when they're there, and getting wins. They are going to be two people that are going to be compared and contrasted throughout their entire careers. I know this is like hindsight's a little 2020, but if you were the Colts, would you have taken Andrew Luck, or would you have gone with Robert Griffin?
No, Andrew Luck, and it's not even close. Not because I think Andrew Luck's a better quarterback, but I think he's a far better fit for the franchise. And I think RG3 is a far better fit for the Washington Redskins. And I think them making the trade with the Rams for that number 2 pick is going to work out beautifully for them. When you are making the pick, you have to look at your franchise. You have to look at your fan base. You have to look at the direction that you want to take the franchise. And I think that Andrew Luck is the perfect type of workman-like personality for the city of Indianapolis. Meanwhile, you look at RG3, he's a businessman. He's flashy. He's got this charisma. He's got kind of a politician swagger.
Right.
Perfect for DC. So I ultimately think it's best case scenario. And I think that because we had the Ryan Leaf, Peyton Manning, those two divergent paths for the Colts and for the Chargers, we're kind of conditioned to believe that one will be successful and one will be a bust. I don't think that's the case with these two men. I think these two guys are both going to be very successful in the NFL, and we'll both be enjoying watching them, kind of like we did Manning versus Brady for a long time.
Absolutely. Or, you know, you could have the opposite. You could have a Jamarcus Russell Brady Quinn debate about which one of them will get kicked out of the league first, right?
Yeah.
So, Julie, before we get you out of here, I have to ask you about the Lakers. I mean, they are 6-4 since Mike Brown's been fired. They brought in Steve Nash. He's been out. His backup Steve Blake is hurt. Pau Gasol has tendonitis. Kobe put up 40 the other day and they lost. How are the fans embracing D'Antoni a week or two after the disappointment of not getting Phil Jackson? And what do we expect from the Lakers going forward?
Gosh, the thing about the Lakers is you really don't know what to expect. You're not sure if you're going to get the good Lakers or the train wreck Lakers. And it sure seemed like last night you got a big, heavy dose of the train wreck Lakers. In fact, we mentioned Norv Turner earlier in the podcast, Mike, and I came up with a term for when things look like everything's going to be perfect and everything's going to be a successful season, and then everything goes horribly wrong, rather inexplicably. That's the term, getting norbed. And the Lakers, Mike, they're getting norbed right now. They have these pieces in place that sure seem like good additions and sure seem like good ideas, and it's just been going wrong fast. And now you look at, as you mentioned, all those problems all heaped together, and D'Antoni's solution is when Steve Nash gets back, it's going to be better. I don't buy that, Mike, because Nash is 39 years old. And he's supposed to lead this team into the promised land. And let's not confuse this issue. They have 1 year to say, Dwight Howard, this is the franchise that you want to stick it out long term with so that you can take over for Kobe Bryant. And right now, it's been a train wreck. Last night when D'Antoni coached, he was the first coach this season that's coached the Lakers for more than 5 games.
Wow.
That's stunning. And so it's just been, you know, the Lakers right now are nothing short of a Hollywood soap opera in the worst way. And then you look across Staples Center and you see the Clippers, and I haven't been able to check the score tonight, but they were taking on the T-Wolves. Chauncey Billups is back. That bench is incredibly deep. You had them, yeah, they just lost 4 in a row, but come on, they were also they're one of the better teams in the NBA also. So the Clippers are choosing a really bad time to face plant. And I don't know that D'Antoni is going to be embraced by Laker fans not because of him, but because of the circumstances surrounding him.
That's unfortunate. I'm from the Northeast. I watched D'Antoni a lot coach the Knicks. That roster was...
Sorry about that.
Yeah, I know. It was unfortunate. I know. That roster was gutted. They didn't have anybody very good other than Danilo Gallinari. I mean, when you're starting Nate Robinson every night, just because he won the slam dunk contest, you're not in a great place. That being said, he has had very good teams in Phoenix. Some of his teams are some of the most entertaining teams to watch. The Lakers, you can't get over the fact that they're old. But
right,
they're a team kind of, I see them kind of like the Celtics a couple, like maybe last year or 2 years ago when they kind of hobbled their way into the playoffs and then they just kind of turned it on. I don't know if the Lakers will turn it on because I don't think they have the team chemistry and they don't have that special player like a Rondo who starts it all up. They're hoping Nash could be that way. But it is hard. You have all these old converging players, and then you have guys like Gasol with the tendonitis. I mean, all it takes is him to go down, and then you're really... You're starting Antoine Jameson and Ron Artest. I mean, that's not the greatest front court possible. Would it be fair to say that the Clippers are gaining share, per se, of fans? Or is there nothing the Clippers can do to ever make it a Clipper town?
Yeah, I don't think there's really anything the Clippers can ever do in L.A.
Right.
But if you're talking about on a national scale, if you're talking on gaining relevance in the nation, kind of like, you know, I'll liken it to what the Saints did in New Orleans. The Saints were a failed franchise for many years. And then they got Drew Brees and Sean Payton and turned that entire ship. The Clippers can do that. Does that mean that they're going to take some of the Laker fans away? No, that's not going to happen. But the Clippers can gain more veracity on a national level in places like Phoenix, in places like Palm Springs, in places, you know, in San Diego, in some of the outlying areas that maybe touch the Southern California market. But no, Laker fans are diehard. And that's why this is another thing that it's very painful for Laker fans to see, because they feel like the Laker front office did everything it could by acquiring Steve Nash and acquiring Dwight Howard. But those acquisitions cost so much money and they gutted their bench. So it's a matter of Laker fans are just kind of scratching their head. They're trying not to panic, but they don't have any reasons not to.
Absolutely. You know, the one plus I guess you can say is D'Antoni doesn't use a deep bench. That being said, he's never coached a team this old, right? It's one thing when
you're
coaching.
That's it. I mean, when you have old bodies, I don't care. You gotta give them rest.
Absolutely. Julie, finally, the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame potential class came out, and there's obviously some interesting names: Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Mike Piazza, Sammy Sosa. They all potentially could have more than one thing in common other than the fact they are in the Hall of Fame class.
Steroids.
Yeah, you said it, not me. What?
Yeah.
What do you think how many of these guys are going to get in? It's unfortunate, players like...
No, it's not.
I was going to say it's unfortunate for players like Craig Biggio, who actually maybe compiled enough numbers to get in, but no one's even going to talk about them. All they're going to talk about is the steroids guys. Who gets in? Do any of them get in? What are we looking at?
No, I don't think any of them should get into the Hall of Fame. I think that the Hall of Fame should maintain a very strict standard and not vote players in for numbers alone, but to maintain that standard and perhaps it's really on the media. It's on people like you and me, Mike, to make sure that we tell the story of the guys that do deserve to be in the Hall of Fame more so than telling the story of the guys that cheated. I think Mark McGwire is the most interesting case there because he has come out and he's admitted it. And now he's back in baseball as a coach. And if he can establish himself and a career as a coach and really help, look what he did for the Cardinals. If he can establish himself as a worthwhile coach, I think he gets in the Hall of Fame and we honor him as a coach. But we can't honor him as a player because he chose to use illegitimate means to achieve his success. And, you know, the only way you right the wrongs, you can't look back, you can't fix what happened, but you can make sure that you make it right now. And that's how you say, I'm sorry. Thank you for acquiring the numbers. Thank you for electrifying the nation with your home run race with Sammy Sosa. But right. You did it illegitimately, and we can't reward you for that. The Hall of Fame is a hallowed place, and it should remain that way. But if he does establish himself as a coach, I would not be opposed to getting him into the Hall of Fame that way and really telling the story of how Mark McGwire has changed baseball through coaching as well as being a player. But I think that's best case scenario. Sammy Sosa, Barry Bonds, no. Mm-mm.
Couldn't I argue, just to play devil's advocate, so they use steroids. Okay. It was not against rules at the time, or there wasn't testing for it, I should say. What's the difference between taking steroids and a cortisone shot, right? Wouldn't they both potentially...
Huge difference.
Well, couldn't they both, they give you a performance advantage or an edge, right?
No, I mean, physiologically... steroids make you stronger without having to work. Now, if you want to get into a conversation about steroids versus HGH, there's a huge conversation to have there, and it's probably something we should save for another podcast. but the difference between a cortisone shot and steroids is giant. Cortisone shots just helps your joint move without pain, but you still have to work out to get stronger. You still have to put in the time in the gym. Steroids, you literally will build muscle if you just stick a needle in your arm, and you'll literally get stronger if you just stick a needle in your butt. And that's a problem in my world. And so while there's more advances in technology, there's more advance in nutrition and training protocol that has helped current players or modern players be more advanced than players in the past, that's been the case for all of the modern players. They've all had access to that knowledge. They have not all stuck needles in their body in order to achieve a higher level of performance without putting the work into it. And that's why steroids is a problem. And that's why I have a very strong opinion that these men should not be in the Hall of Fame that did steroids.
I agree with you, but I have heard people make that argument before. I say the same thing you do. But, hey, listen, some people genuinely believe that.
No question. And some people think that, hey, the pitchers were cheating too. So and how does doing steroids help you swing a bat further or faster so that you get there, you hit more home runs? And all that, you know, you can split hairs. It's all hair splitting in my world. The bottom line is these men didn't want to put the work in to be great. Would Barry Bonds have been a Hall of Famer had he not done steroids? Absolutely. Man, that guy was a phenomenal baseball player. But he felt he needed to cheat and create an unlevel playing field in order to reach that next level. And that's a problem. And so you don't get the Hall of Fame for that.
I think it's exactly well said. It is interesting, though, on a broader and outside or a long-term view, how steroids have really, it seems to me, hurt baseball, its brand, whereas steroids in football, they don't even care. People just, whatever. 4-game suspension, done. No big deal. Look at Sean Merriman, right? People don't even talk about him, not because
he's
steroids.
How about Brian Cushing as a rookie?
Exactly.
Was suspended. Yep.
Exactly. But they don't talk about them as, like, in the case of Merriman or Cushing, they don't talk about them as bad people for using steroids. I mean, nobody talks about Sean Merriman because he's not productive anymore and Cushing's hurt, but it's just kind of swept under the rug and moved on. Do you think that's because football tends to be maybe a more progressive in the terms of youthful or looking forward viewership or viewers, where baseball tends to really, really want to hold on to tradition no matter what.
No, I think it's actually more a matter of nobody in football that has established themselves as an all-time great or has obliterated records or has done things that was never seen before has been found doing steroids. Whereas in baseball, if you look at the home run list, career home run list, you go down and there's an asterisk next to half the name.
Right.
And that's why I think it's a bigger deal in baseball, because they've changed the history of baseball. You know, I had this conversation on my show the other day. I said, what if, hypothetically speaking, Drew Brees, who just beat Johnny Unitas, who just beat Dan Marino, these are some of the longest standing records in the NFL. What if it came out that he was doing performance enhancing drugs? Would all of a sudden the baseball audience and baseball fans, or I'm sorry, football fans, would they all of a sudden turn their attention to this problem? Because you're right, it definitely seems like there's a huge disparity. And I think that would be the case. If there were names in the record books that you had to put asterisks next to in the NFL, I think we'd start caring about performance-enhancing drugs more in the NFL. But the bottom line is, especially on defense, these guys are just, you know, a lot of them that have been they're linebackers. They don't acquire stats. They don't acquire, you know, Hall of Fame status. They don't acquire this revered plateau that some of these baseball numbers do. And therefore, it isn't quite a shock to the system when they're suspended for performance-enhancing drugs.
Right, that's a good point. I also think there's an obsession about numbers in baseball. You know, like there's these benchmarks that people hit, right? You had a great old, I guess, non-moneyball philosophy, you'd say. You hit 300, you had a big year, right? You hit 50 home runs, you had a monster year. With football, I mean, sometimes maybe it's because the college game, the passing yards are inflated, or maybe it's because football, I mean, they sell a level of violence and collision, which, I mean, I'm a huge football fan. I love it, and I think most people do too, but it you're right. There aren't as much of an aura around, you know, when Barry Bonds was having his home run race and shooting steroids probably every other second.
Well, if I ask you who's leading Major League in home runs, you'll tell me. If I ask you who's leading the NFL in tackles, do you know?
I mean, off the top of my head, I would guess Patrick Willis, maybe.
No, it's Jared Mayo, actually, with the Patriots.
But there you go.
Shocking, right? But again, we don't really pay attention to tackles. And I mean, we do pay attention to fantasy numbers on offense, but for that reason, fantasy.
Right.
But you're right. There's more of an attention to numbers in baseball, and the cheaters have been caught, happen to be at the top of those lists.
Right.
And
right.
So it's even a bigger slap in the face to the baseball fan. With the NFL, the cheaters that have been caught have been linebackers that, you know, lights out. Sean Merriman has a pretty cool nickname. Brian Cushing, one of the better linebackers as a rookie, was caught, but he was a rookie. So it didn't really shock the nation that much. But when A-Rod comes out and he is now, you know, ascending the ladder of career home runs, and we all know he cheated, then that's a slap in the face every time he hits another home run.
That absolutely is. The question would be, do you think Americans or baseball fans, I should say, are numb to this? Or would,
no.
Let's say if Albert Pujols hypothetically came out and tested positive, would there be a huge uproar? Or do you think people...
Huge. Oh, that would just cripple the Angels. Oh, that would just be heartbreaking. I mean, that would just be heartbreaking. Yeah, if Pujols is seen as one of the good guys. He's seen as one of the clean guys. He's seen as one of the guys that might have done it legitimately. And if it comes out that he's dirty too, oh, that would just be an absolute donkey kick to the teeth.
But I think a lot of people don't tend to hold that out against Ryan Braun. I mean, I know a lot of baseball fans you talk to. I know that he got out on a technicality. The sample was, the process wasn't fully done to the letter of the law, but I think it's relatively well known. I mean, he probably was a cheater, but people don't seem to care, I think. And he's one of the biggest stars in the game, name-wise, anyway.
Yeah, I think it might matter where he plays.
Right.
Milwaukee isn't really a big market. And then it also matters, I think, who you're talking to. But I think most importantly, it matters where he plays and how legitimate the team is and how big of a star he is. Ryan Braun, I think last year, really did light Major League Baseball on fire. But when you win that appeal, people give you the benefit of the doubt. And then I think, too, you might, if you talk to some different generations, you might find a little bit of a different story. But the other thing, I mean, Albert Pujols, he has set records.
Right.
You know, he's done things on such a consistent level, the 40 home runs in, 10 straight years. And he has done things like that that puts him in the record books. Ryan Braun had a MVP year, but I don't think he set any records doing so. So
that's a good point.
If Miguel Cabrera came out that he was on juice and he just got the first Triple Crown since 1967, do you think there would be national outcry about that?
No, there definitely would be. That's a fair point.
Yeah. But That'd be big.
I think a lot of people in the media get very upset about it, and rightly they should, right? That's their job to cover the story. But I get the sense maybe this is just my generation of baseball fans. It's not that big of a deal. I mean, I don't think that's the way it should be. But I think people kind of just assume that baseball players, when they have huge years, there might be something wrong with them. But that, you know, based upon history, that's what tend to happen. People have big years. So I mean, besides the fact that he was using steroids, he had the cork bat, for instance, right? Barry Bonds' head grew, which it blows my mind how people didn't figure that out quicker. You're right, but it's true. You're right. I mean, a guy like Pujols, who's revered, and he should be, based upon he's a good guy, he's a great player, maybe something like that would happen. That might change the discussion for kids or people my generation, I would say.
Yeah, I think that ultimately that is a sad statement that people, fans, baseball fans, and I'm more of a football fan myself, but you're right in that baseball fans have, in a lot of ways, especially younger generations, have become desensitized to steroids. And even to the point that they say, what's the big deal? Let everybody do it. And that's problematic because, again, it physiologically changes you. There are vast consequences to doing those performance-enhancing drugs that a lot of people don't know about, and the media certainly doesn't talk about because the media is not educated on it. The media is not, you know, they're journalists. They're not doctors.
Right.
So they can't possibly be educated on it. But that's the problem with it. And when you talk about doing it in the pros, you got to talk about doing it in the college ranks, and then you talk about doing it at the high school level, and then you get into some serious, serious health consequences. And that's why it's such a big problem. That's why I think it's really important that we not become desensitized to it. When I talk about it on my radio show, I make sure I have very strong statements about the illegitimacy of anyone who chooses to do performance-enhancing drugs because it is a cultural phenomenon that we want to achieve greatness in as little time as possible. And that's not how it works, Mike.
Yeah.
You don't wake up one morning and have 17-inch biceps and be able to launch a ball 500 feet. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of dedication and hard work. And you know what? It should. Mike, it should take you a long time to reach the plateau of broadcasting that you want to achieve. It should take anyone a lot of work, a lot of dedication, and a lot of practice to become an expert in any field. And for us as a culture to expect greatness in overnight is erroneous. And I think we need to change the culture of our nation if we want to make sure that the performance-enhancing drugs don't become a bigger problem.
I think that's a great point. You know, that comes down to the Malcolm Gladwell, the 10,000-hour rule. If you want to be an expert in anything, it takes you about 10,000 hours to do it. You're right. It should take a long time to do anything. It should take a long time to hit a fastball at 96 miles an hour, 550 feet. It should take you a long time to figure out what defensive coverages people are looking at look at other sports to flip a puck into a net where a goalie is blocking it at like 100 miles an hour, like some of these hockey players can do. You're right. It should take a long time. It's unfortunate, though, that desensitization is happening. But maybe I'm off base. Maybe it's just the people I talk to. I am more of a football fan myself, but it is sad to see that about baseball. But, Julie, I would say thanks a lot for coming on the show. I don't think anyone listening would not know you have you bring it every time, which is fantastic. Where can we find you? What are some of the things we can see find your radio show? Where can we find more content from you?
Go to team1010.com. Every week I have my NFL picks. And actually this week, Mike, I exposed the Super Bowl curse Everybody knows about the Madden curse. People know about the SI cover curse. But did you know that in the 46 years of the Super Bowl, only 10 teams that had hosted the Super Bowl made the playoffs the same year?
That's unbelievable.
Only two teams in NFL history have hosted the Super Bowl and played in the game. And only one team out of 46 opportunities, that would be the 1984 49ers, actually won the Super Bowl the year they hosted it. That was up in Stanford, so technically it wasn't really their stadium, but it's close enough. So we just exposed that at team1010.com. And then, of course, people can always watch my show on Ustream. They can just search Bueller's Day Off on Ustream or go to team1010.com and all the content's there. Poke around a little bit.
Oh, they can also follow you on Twitter. I believe it's Julie_Bueller, right? Am I right?
That's
there?
Right. That's right. There is an H in my last name, B-U-E-H-L-E-R.
That's it. Obviously, that's Julie. She is fantastic. Julie, thanks a lot.
Mike, always a pleasure. Anytime, sir.
Arizona tonight.
Now, Arizona State cannot give up a score. They need to make a play, take the ball away.
Scott, keeper. Fumbles. Loose ball. Still loose. Kicked all the way back to the 45, where it's picked up by Devaron Carr.
But it's just a tough deal when you're trying to take on 300-pound linemen and you can't get off of them.
So the true freshman backup, C.J. Dozier, in to replace Flowers. Second and two. Grice into the end zone again. Third rushing touchdown. All three of the touchdowns for Grice and Arizona State off of turnovers by Matt Scott and the Wildcats. Wildcats.
Oh, this is getting a bit dangerous for Arizona. They're so far backed up.
The momentum has swung again, this time to the Sun Devils. The takeaway, touchdown, and now a three and out by Arizona State. Dukancic's punt is blocked. It will be first and goal, Arizona State. Cameron Marshall, touchdown, Sun Devils lead.
Fourth and six.
Arizona's going for it. Scott, slant, incomplete, intercepted off the hands of Hill. It's another pick for Arizona State, and Robert Nelson still rolling all the way to the one. This is Michael Eubank in at quarterback. Eubank sneaks, waiting for the signal. Touchdown, Arizona State.
Into third down now. Obviously, by those video clips, you could detect that Arizona State was able to upset the Wildcats 41-34. It was a great game played by the Sun Devils. Capped off by, of course, the Michael Eubank touchdown, the last score. The big plays in the games are the ones that I highlighted for you as the Sun Devils, down 10, score 24 in the fourth quarter to upset the Cats in Tucson. It was a full-fledged effort by Arizona State. The quarterback, Taylor Kelly, 16 of 29 for 191 yards, averaging 6.6 yards per completion. The running backs, it was a fantastic game for Marion Grice. I tweeted that it was a coming-out party for Marion Grice. Grice, 18 carries for 156 yards, three touchdowns, a long of 52. Contributions from DJ Foster, 16 carries for 49 yards, and Cameron Marshall, 9 carries for 21 yards. The Sun Devils laid it on the Cats on the ground, 55 carries for 269 yards, 5 touchdowns for the Devils. Like I said, 3 for Marion Grice. He was fantastic for Arizona State. But the key for the Devils was not just their ability to chew up clock and move the ball on the ground. It was their ability to capitalize on turnovers. Arizona quarterback Matt Scott had himself a productive game if you take away the interception. Scott, 19 of 39, 230 yards, three touchdowns, but as I stated, the three interceptions. For Scott, it was a difficult game for the fifth-year senior from Corona, California. It's the guy Ivan Mazel and I talked about earlier in the year. Rich Rodriguez really liked Matt Scott. He had 12 interceptions on the year. Coming into the game, he only had 9. For the Sun Devils to be able to turn Matt Scott over, that was fantastic. That was the story for Arizona State. In addition to the three Matt Scott turnovers, the Devils were able to also force a fumble. Additionally, they were able to block a punt, which turned into those 7 points, Grice's third touchdown of the day. For the Devils, the defense was great. Nelson, an interception, and then a 66-yard return, which set up the Cameron Marshall touchdown. Keelan Johnson, an interception. Asahan Irabor, an interception. Receiving for the Devils, Jamal Miles, 5 catches, 39 yards. Foster, 2 catches, 38 yards. Those are the two leading receivers for Arizona State. Before we get to the negatives, I'd like to highlight what we saw from Arizona. They had a very productive offensive game. Garrick Wharton, 6 catches, 89 yards, and a touchdown long of 40. Productive. Austin Hill, 5 catches, 70 yards. For the exception of that drop, which turned into the Nelson interception, he played well. Kadeem Carey, he deserves a tip of the cap. If you're an Arizona State fan, or you're a fan in college football in general, Carey came into the game leading the nation in rushing. He leaves with 25 carries, 172 yards, and a touchdown. Very productive game for Kadeem Carey. His backup, Darrell Scott, 21 carries, 78 yards. Very productive. Matt Scott, productive as well on the ground with 11 carries, 42 yards, but did have that key fumble. The 4 turnovers for the Devils, that was the difference. Arizona State came into the fourth quarter needing something big to happen, and that's exactly what they got. In previous years, the Arizona State-Arizona games, it's been games in which you can throw the records out. You never know what could happen. 2 years ago in Tucson, James Brooks, the blocked field goal on the kicker Zendejas for Arizona, ultimately allows the Devils to win. This year, it was Arizona State's defense to get turnovers and yet another big special teams play, a blocked field goal, which sets up the tie and then ultimately swings all of the momentum to Arizona State for the lead and to blow this game out of proportion. Now, the final score is Arizona State 41, Arizona 34. But after that blocked punt, the complexion of the game totally changed. Arizona State was extremely energetic, as they should be in a rivalry game. Sets up recruiting for the entire offseason, something that Rich Rodriguez is going to have to deal with if he wants to regroup the Arizona program. The negatives, though, for ASU, and they were there. They did give up 34 points, even with the 4 turnovers. That's not great defense, but ASU did enough and made enough big plays when it mattered to get the victory. Additionally, Arizona State bit on an extra point fake 2-point conversion. That's not positive. That will have to be shored up in the future going into the bowl game. But the real negative, it's hard to rag on a team or a player in which you get a big rivalry game that meant everything to ASU this season. But I have to make an objective exception here for Rashard Ross. Ross, with the blazing speed, used to stretch the defense. We all know why he is on the ASU team. Ross had 2 catches for 26 yards. But the big plays, the things that matter the most, but the 2 big plays that Rashard Ross needed to make, he did not. Taylor Kelly, in the second half, threw a deep ball to Ross, who was able to beat the coverage relatively easily by running right past the defensive backs for the Cats. Did not convert on the play. A ball that Rod Gilmore in the coverage on ESPN said Kelly may have overthrown him. At the end of the day, Rashard Ross needs to bring that football in. It bounced off his fingertips. That's unacceptable. Additionally, they go back to Ross. The same drive. In the end zone. Doesn't get the job done with the drop pass. That is not acceptable for Ross if he wants to play at the next level. He has the speed to, but the hands clearly are not there for the ASU wide receiver. That being said, the Devils defense played fantastic and did the job that was needed. This game for Arizona State ultimately means more than any game this season, because where Arizona State was a few weeks ago is not where the Devils wanted to be. Todd Graham came in and after 6 games sat at 5-1, 3 in the conference, beating up on Northern Arizona and Illinois, a tough loss at Missouri, demolishing Utah, surviving at California, creaming Colorado. Then they came in and lost to Oregon, UCLA, Oregon State, USC. 4 losses in a row. Two weekends ago, I said if they wanted to go to a bowl game, they needed to beat Washington State. They did. They responded, beating the Cougars 46-7. A Cougar team, mind you, that beat Washington this weekend in a rivalry game. Clearly, there is some talent there. Friday, the Devils did the job. They go to Tucson. They knock off the 24-ranked Arizona Wildcats. But ultimately, this is exactly the game that Todd Graham needed. This is exactly the game that Arizona State needed. The Devils go into the bowl season, bowl eligible. ESPN projects the Devils will either play in the Fight Hunger Bowl against Navy in San Francisco or the Las Vegas Bowl, a rematch against the Boise State Broncos, a team that embarrassed the Sun Devils in the Las Vegas Bowl last year. Either way, the Devils go into the bowl game 7-5 with a two-game winning streak, feeling great about themselves. The defense played like they were possessed, and the offense did not make any mistakes, which are critical. The Devils were able to control the ball, not turn it over, and do exactly what Todd Graham wants them to do. Run the football early and often. And when you have a back like Marion Grice, who has clearly surpassed the senior Cameron Marshall and the freshman DJ Foster, clearly has surpassed them, there's a real sense of offensive identity with Arizona State. Grice on the season, now mind you, splitting carries with two other accomplished backs, 89 carries, 520 yards, averaging 5.8 yards per carry, along a 52, 9 rushing touchdowns, receiving 39 balls caught, 406 yards accumulated, averaging 10.4 yards per reception, along of 37 and 8 touchdowns. When Grice can play and run the football as he has, it allows DJ Foster, the team's second leading receiver, 36 catches, 522 yards, and averaging 14.5 yards per reception and 4 touchdowns, to play more receiver. Makes the Sun Devils much more dynamic. That is exactly what you want to see out of ASU. Clearly, it cements Marion Grice's role as the lead back, the workhorse back, next season for ASU as we project down the line. But the key note from this game over the Cats was that the Sun Devils were able to bring the cup back to Tempe, were able to play an exciting brand of football, and really were able to make a statement in a primetime Friday night game on ESPN to all recruits out there that the number one team in the state of Arizona is in Tempe. It is the Sun Devils and not the Wildcats. Which brings us to fourth down. Former LSU defensive back Tyrann Mathieu, the Honey Badger as he is known, has elected to enter the 2013 NFL draft. Now here's what we do know about Tyrann Mathieu. On the field, Mathieu is one of the most electric players in college football. Probably the best defensive player in the nation. 6 forced fumbles last year. He was 3rd in college football in punt return yardage. 2 touchdowns, including 1 in the SEC championship game over Georgia. And he had 3 of his 6 touchdowns scored while LSU was trailing, when the lights were hottest and brightest. That's when Tyrann Mathieu came to play. But we also know, with the talent that Tyrann Mathieu has, there is a lot of baggage. Mathieu was suspended from the team due to a substance abuse issue. His 3rd failed drug test, at which point Les Miles dismissed Mathieu. The Honey Badger elected to stay at LSU in hopes of maybe working his way back on the team. Here's what we know that Tyrann Mathieu did do. Mathieu was arrested for possession of drugs with former teammate, former LSU quarterback, Jordan Jefferson. If Tyrann Mathieu did not get it then, what will make him get it now? It is unbelievable to me that Tyrann Mathieu thinks that he deserves a shot at the NFL. The NFL is a privilege, not a right. LSU football is a privilege and not a right. And that's a privilege that Mathieu has violated. to the point when Les Miles banished his Heisman Trophy finalist because he couldn't stay clean or he couldn't stop doing drugs. Now, Matthew has tackled this problem head on. He was quoted as saying, "I am sorry that I was not able to complete my journey at LSU, but I will always support LSU in any way I can. To all my teammates, you are my brothers. You have kept me going. I will do my best to make you all proud of me." Tyron, here's a newsflash. When you get dismissed from your team and you take an entire year off of football, besides the fact that Matthew, while a tremendous college player, his NFL dominance was nowhere near guaranteed. Matthew listed at 5'9", 170 pounds as a cornerback. It would be very difficult for a guy like the Honey Badger, as explosive as he is with the football in his hands, to cover a guy like Brandon Marshall in the NFL, to cover a Calvin Johnson, or even a Julio Jones at the next level. Matthew has nowhere near the coverage ability of a guy like Darrell Revis of the Jets, or even another troubled cornerback now with the New England Patriots, formerly of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Aqib Talib. So where does Tyron Matthew fit into the equation? He's too small to play safety, clearly. 170 pounds and 5'9 is not going to get the job done at safety, which leaves Matthew at most likely a slot inside corner coverage guy and a kick and punt returner. Now, if you were playing a video game and you just had to sign a player without any of the baggage, just based upon his raw ability, Tyron Matthew could play on my team any day of the week and twice on Sunday. But this is real life. And this is not a guy I would take a chance on, because he has shown time and time again, irresponsibility is not getting the job done. We've seen organizations like the New England Patriots thrive on high-character guys, where they took a couple gambles on Chad Johnson and Albert Haynesworth. Neither of those two worked out. We saw again, Johnson got an opportunity with the Miami Dolphins. We've all seen the video of him being cut by Joe Philbin, his coach. The NFL is littered with guys with character problems. The Cowboys took a chance on Adam Pac-Man Jones after he was cut from the Tennessee Titans. Maybe Tyron Matthew will prove us all wrong. But here's what I do know. Matthew has a very, very steep hill to climb. And if I was an NFL team or an NFL GM, I would not be his light at the end of the tunnel. Which brings us to Fifth Down. You can get in touch with the show by emailing fifthdowncfb@gmail.com. The most direct way would be to tweet me at fifthdownmike. And that will be the show tonight. I would like to take another moment to thank 1010KXPS's own Julie Bueller of the Bueller's Day Off program. Remember, you can get in touch with the show by tweeting me at fifthdownmike, or you can email the show at fifthdowncfb@gmail.com. Thanks for downloading us.